That was the moment I decided I'm leaving academia. It took a little bit longer than that, but ultimately I ended up in Washington, D.C. And I was like, I'm going to be the bridge between academia and policy and really ensure that science policy issues like climate change and all of its impacts are entrenched in the science and in the data. And I'm going to help my academic colleagues who are brilliant, maybe not the best communicators, but brilliant, share their ideas in a way that it's actually used, it's actually implemented. That's what we were missing. And that was that moment for me that I decided that's where I was going to focus my time.
Hello and welcome to the Women of the Future podcast, a podcast made in collaboration with the Women of the Future program, a platform built to unlock a culture of kindness and collaboration among leaders, as well as support and celebrate the successes of women. I'm Kim Rowell and I won the media category at their awards in 2018 in recognition of my continued work as a commissioner, producer and children's author, particularly within the mental health remit. I'll be talking to my guests on this podcast about their careers, who or what gave them their first big break, their successes, failures, and inspirations along the way, and how they came to be a part of the Women of the Future network.
Dr. Sweta Chakraborty is a behavioural scientist whose work is motivated by the need for clear, credible science communication to urgently and proactively manage the risks that threaten human security and well-being, encompassing everything from climate change to COVID-19. Sweta brings a unique blend of academic as well as public and private sector expertise as a communicator and consultant, merging science, policy and the media to get decision makers the information they need for better behavioural outcomes, with the intention of having a positive impact on the planet. Currently, the US representative for We Don't Have Time, the world's largest climate action network, known for launching Greta Thunberg to global renown. She is also the host of Risky Behaviour, a dynamic podcast that explores controversial issues and discusses a variety of topics ranging from nutrition and climate change to sex and prescription drugs. Sweta is a correspondent for multiple publications, a book author, a TEDx and globally recognised keynote speaker, and is regularly featured on global media outlets such as CNN, Fox News, MSNBC and the BBC. In her own words, she has chosen to be an unapologetic communicator of sciences and facts, and she thrives in it.
I'm from Randolph, New Jersey. I like to say I'm from New York City because I thought that sounded so much cooler than New Jersey. But as an adult now, looking back on it, I had a lovely suburban upbringing. I really appreciated my immigrant parents from Calcutta, India, making the effort to give me and my sister as normal of an American school experience as possible. So we went to public school. And because of that, my father sacrificed not living in New York or closer to work just so we could go to a better school. And so he would be driving from Randolph, New Jersey to Brooklyn, where he worked every single day. And that was a 2-hour commute on a good day. Wow. And so then after September 11th, that commute became something like 4 hours each way, which was absolutely insane. And I just think about the immigrants from that generation and how they could put up with that. If I'm on the subway more than 10 minutes, I'm annoyed, right? To get from point A to point B. So I'm very grateful for that sacrifice that he was able to make so that we could go to a good school district in New Jersey. And then very much an Indian family. We were conservative because we were the diaspora and we created a little bubble and I didn't know any better. So for me, it was very normal to speak Bengali at home and to be eating, you know, fish every night for dinner with my hands. And so figuring out how to be Bengali and to keep that identity while still really merging into American culture, that was probably the most unique struggle I faced because, again, very suburban white neighborhood in Randolph, New Jersey, and then me being the only non-Caucasian in my year, and that improved over the years. But at least in the beginning, there was definitely that struggle to balance both of those worlds. And so I think that really shaped a lot of who I am today.
It's really fascinating to hear you speak about it like that, because I imagine when you were growing up and when you're actually in that situation as a young child, did you have much understanding of the things you were talking about, like your dad's sacrifice, how the community and the influences, how all of that was affecting you? Because I suppose now you have the benefit of hindsight and you can look at it and think, that's what that was. But at the time, was it really affecting? Because I think kids are very present, aren't they? Kids are in the moment. But were you aware of all of these things that you were just talking about?
Absolutely not. I was so spoiled. I remember my father's mother spent the first 5 years of my life with us in New Jersey, and then switching that around, father's mother and then mother's mother. And my mother's mother, by the time she came, I was in fifth grade and then going into middle school. And so she would make these incredible vegetarian wraps. And I remember taking them to school and everybody else had these like ham and bologna sandwiches. And they were so basic and so plain and white bread and all of the things that you see advocates fighting for against now in school cafeterias, right? Mm. I would show up and the kids would be like, what smells? What is that? Really, there it's the waft of like delicious curry, homemade vegetables and all of that. And so, but just to fit in, I would try to trade and then I'd come home. I would trade my beautiful Indian home-cooked food for a bologna sandwich.
Oh, yuck.
White bread, just to fit in. My gosh. So no, I didn't at the time. I really didn't appreciate what I had. And then, yeah, the benefit of hindsight, right? Just looking back and being so grateful now that I can speak Bengali fluently. Mm. That being said, I was recently asked to do an interview on television in Calcutta, India. And that's when I realized I don't actually have proficiency, professional proficiency in Bengali, but I can definitely throw it down. If you take me to any location in Calcutta or Bangladesh, I can definitely hold my own.
Good. That's how it should be, right? All the cultural influences is what you're talking about. But I was interested to know what you were like as a student, because where you're at right now in your career, over here, we call it a multi-hyphen, really. I don't know if you have the same kind of terminology in the US, but you do an awful lot of things incredibly well. But when you were a student, were you like that? Did you like a little bit of everything? Did you like mixing it up? Or did you know where your passions were? What motivated you? Where did your inspirations come from?
I would say that you really can't win at pursuing something that you don't care about or you're not passionate about. And so coming from an Indian family, very much the stereotypical, be a lawyer, be an engineer, be a doctor. But none of those things suited me. And like, if I was going to pursue one of those avenues, I probably would have been fine, but I wouldn't have excelled necessarily. So there's always going to be somebody that's more passionate than you pursuing a area, field, or even a discipline to study that really wants to be there. And if you don't, then that's going to show. So the key to really succeeding is to really follow through with what it is that you care about. And we're naturally gifted in different ways. And so there is a natural spread of people and interest and expertise. So whatever you're feeling inclined towards, move towards. That's what I tell anyone I'm mentoring or any students that ask me what I did through my studies and how I ended up being where I am. It's because I just really followed through with what was interesting for me and what I was passionate about. Because you really just put that much more effort in, right? And my parents really wanted me to become a doctor. And so I kind of tricked them, not an MD, but a PhD. I still can say doctor, right? I won't always say it in front of a MD, but I have the title. So that was kind of my loophole around it to still make them happy. But no, as a student, I pursued everything that interested me. And ultimately, it's a little bit of like the Forrest Gump, right? It's kind of you pursue various things and then different opportunities open. The more open you are to things and the more things you say yes to earlier on in your career, which you should definitely become more careful of as you move through your career trajectory. But in the beginning, it's smart to say yes as much as possible, to gain as much experience, to be as open-minded. And then you'll get these different opportunities. Doors will open, doors will close, and you'll find yourself exactly where you're meant to be. Just stay true to yourself and truly pursue what interests you.
And it is whatever gives you energy. Someone very wise once said that to me. That's what you're saying, isn't it? You pursue your passion because you're more likely to be committed to them longer term. But I'm wondering also, like with the international side of your academic life, how was that? Was that a challenge? Did you enjoy that experience? What was it like for you?
So I'll say that the reason I went to the UK to do my PhD and my postdoc was because, one, I realized what a bubble we were in the United States. And it's true. And I have so many British friends and your accent is making me super nostalgic right now because I lived in London for years and years through most of my 20s. I realized once I went to LSC as an undergraduate to do a study abroad that we have a very limited view on world history and world politics. And we are taught it in American public schools, even in the best schools, from the American lens. And so coming to the UK was very eye-opening to actually view what was going on in the world from a different perspective. And I really enjoyed it and it really opened my eyes. So then I went back to the US to finish my final year of undergraduate, but I couldn't get out of there fast enough. Let me tell you, I was so yearning to get back to the UK, mainly because if I was going to do higher education, I wanted that global perspective. And I just fell in love with London. So I went back and I did my PhD. And to be quite frank, it's faster, right? In the US, a PhD can take like 7-8 years. You're required to take courses as well. But if you really know what you want to work on, if you know what your thesis is, which honestly, completely honestly, I had no idea what I was going to be doing, but I knew I could, once I figured it out, I would get it done quickly. So I went to the UK because there's a lot more, okay, just get on with it. We don't need to hold your hand through everything. We don't need to spoon feed you everything. So, you know, contribute something to the field and let's get you that doctorate degree. So I really liked that kind of general approach to your graduate degree in graduate studies. And then the postdoc, just being at Oxford, was one of the most incredible experiences as an American, as a fan of Harry Potter.
It's all coming out now.
Yeah, I mean, it's just stunning. It's such a beautiful place and there's so much history. And you really could be walking down the street and be rubbing shoulders with the finance minister or some dignitary visiting from another country. And then the dinners that they would host there, which I love that they do this for students, but you would be sitting at a table. And then in between courses, they would have you switch positions. So then you'd be sitting next to somebody else. And again, you could be rubbing elbows with anyone. I mean, any dignitary visiting the university, a different professor from a completely different school. And that was the kind of experience that was so unique that I would never have had otherwise. And I really appreciated my time in London. I appreciated my time in Oxford. And it really was about just kind of getting things done a little bit faster and getting on with it. Why in the US is undergraduate 4 years? And in the UK, you get to have a gap year, which is incredible. And then you kind of get through your education and then become a contributing member to society. I love that.
And I like what you're saying about that kind of exposure. So lots of different people from all different walks of life, because that's really formative and it challenges you and it forces you to think more broadly and all of that kind of thing. But I wanted to talk more about where you're at right now and where your focus is in your career. But also, has there been a standout moment, or maybe it was a person or someone said something once and it just maybe triggered something that really made you steadfast in your desire to go down this path and, you know, this is where all your energy was going to go?
Oh, I love this question because something immediately comes to mind and I don't think I've ever said it publicly. I say it at dinner parties and when somebody asks me something similar, but I don't think I've actually ever put it on the record. So here we go. George Atkinson.
Okay.
He was my first boss. He was the science advisor to Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell, previous secretaries of state in the US. And he left as science advisors to secretaries of state and started his own organization called the Institute on Science for Global Policy. I was at Oxford. That's where I met him. I was giving a presentation and he came up to me afterwards and said, do you think any of this research is actually making its way to policymakers? I mean, you're here in academia and you're talking about really relevant things. My field is behavioral science, right? So understanding how the brain works and how humans process information and then how we should use that to solve some of these major global challenges. Climate change is what I focus on now, but I'm talking about infectious disease outbreaks and food security issues and nuclear power. And all of these things can apply the field of behavioral science to address, to kind of help find social science solutions for. And so I was all, you know, young, excited at the time and expressing how all of this research was really gonna solve all these global world problems. And it was such a moment when George came up to me and was like, do you think this is actually getting to any of the policymakers, local to federal to multilateral? Do you think the UN is using any of this? Do you think? And I remember in that moment, I was so shocked because I just assumed that research and academia was making its way to, you know, every decision that was being made, evidence-based policymaking, right? I just assumed that. Mm. And the naive younger version of me learned really quickly that that was not the case. And if it wasn't for academics and scientists and researchers really making an effort to move their science and data to these decision makers, it wasn't happening naturally. There were efforts in place, but ultimately, it was whatever was politically expedient is what would rule the day. It was whatever the pet interest of the decision makers were that would really carry through. And so that was the moment I decided I'm leaving academia. It took a little bit longer than that, but ultimately I ended up in Washington, D.C. And I was like, I'm going to be the bridge between academia and policy and really ensure that science policy issues like climate change and all of its impacts are entrenched in the science and in the data. And I'm going to help my academic colleagues who are brilliant maybe not the best communicators, but brilliant, share their ideas in a way that it's actually used, it's actually implemented. That's what we were missing. And that was that moment for me that I decided that's where I was going to focus my time.
You've described yourself as an unapologetic communicator of science and fact, and that you thrive in it. And that's exactly what you're talking about there, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, because I will basically, when I do media, right, and I go on what's considered a left-wing media versus right-wing media, and all of these anchors try to put an adjective in front of scientists by asking if I'm a conservative scientist or a liberal scientist. And that's where I came with this unapologetic communicator. If anything, I'm a radical centrist in that I'm going to stick to the facts no matter what side it ends up falling on. Mm. Because the right will get it wrong more frequently, for sure. The left will get it wrong. And ultimately, it's where the science lies that will prevail. I mean, we will learn that in time. If we don't act on it in the moment, we'll regret it. And we'll learn in time that would have been the best course of action. That's what history has shown us across any single one of these science challenges we've been facing. So that's why, unapologetically, I refuse to be labeled as in any sort of political way, and rather just, I am vanguard of the facts.
Mm. It's slightly going off on a tangent, but I was having the exact same conversation with my partner last night because we were watching Painkiller on Netflix, which is about the opioid crisis in the US. And it's terrifying. It's literally terrifying. I literally watch it. Sometimes I can't breathe. I find that I'm actually holding my breath. But it's this kind of thing that what you were just talking about. Like, the people that are making the decisions don't know the ins and outs of it. They have no understanding or comprehension of the actual science and data and facts. And that, for me, and I'm assuming in what you've just said as well, is terrifying. And someone like yourself bridging that void is exactly what we need more of.
Absolutely. I mean, it's always going to swing in one direction or the other in terms of where the public stands on something based on who's taking the bullhorn and screaming the loudest into it. But the one thing we can hang our hats on is data, is evidence. Mm. But that doesn't resonate, right, with the public. And so another thing that I have been hammering away on pretty much since I've been in Washington, pretty much since the start of my career, to my fellow colleagues in academia, is that we can't just hit people over the head with numbers and data, right? That's what will win the day, for sure. That's what we need to be following as we make decisions about where to allocate our money and time and resources, all of that. What should we be prioritizing? What risk should we focus on? All of that is based in data. But why is that not winning out? Why hasn't that obvious fact been the way politics and policy has been shaped? It's because you get charismatic, sometimes dangerous charismatic policymakers in place that scream really loudly into the bullhorns. And that's what moves public opinion and public support. And we need to take a page out of that book. We need to learn from that. And there's science that explains why that works, right? Mm. This is the science of communicating science. Maybe we don't tell everyone the data, the numbers, and the facts. And this is really hard for academics, right? Because they just keep saying, come on, this is so obvious. Look at the numbers. But that doesn't resonate. What resonates is the person who's the most charismatic, or the person, rather, actually, what my whole academic research has been on is trust. It's who you trust the most. And so if you can get, and this is going to sound, I'm being somewhat facetious, but it's actually not inaccurate. If you can get like Taylor Swift, or if you can get somebody like Kim Kardashian, even for those audiences that love them, right? Mm. That follow everything that they do, Kate Middleton. And if you can get one of them to say, this is what we need to prioritize, this is what we need to care about, that is the game changer. That's how you're going to move the public support. And we need to do that very strategically. And we need to segment audiences around the world, identify who they trust, partner with those trusted spokespeople, the ones that are willing to be on the side of science, and get the message out that way. And that's something we haven't done. And that's something the science community kind of sticks its nose up at. No, just give them the data, just give them the numbers. So part of my goal also, and maybe your audience will see, I do a lot with different celebrities and influencers for really this reason, is because these sort of partnerships go a long way in changing human behavior.
I couldn't agree more. And I've seen you speaking with Moby, and I think with Joaquin Phoenix, and you have your own podcast, and you're, like you say, you do an awful lot of work with media, both within the US and internationally. You're an author. It's just, you've done so much, and you've got so many accolades and strings to your bow to try and reinforce this message. But I was curious as to whether there was anything in particular that stands out for you, or that you're particularly proud of as an achievement, or it felt like you were forging forwards and making change.
There's been every time something happens and I pause and I take stock and I'm like, this was incredible. I can't believe I pulled this off with the help of an incredible team. Then another thing happens and then I pause and I have to pinch myself again. And I'm like, okay, that wasn't a one-off. This is actually, I've created a regular stream of cool happenings. And that's something to actually pause and take stock of, that I'm so blessed that, you know, these things really just weren't just a peak, but rather it's a movement towards what I hope to continue to be able to do on a regular basis. So for example, yes, the interview with Joaquin Phoenix, that I thought was such a, I'm never going to be able to do anything like that again. But then fast forward to interviewing Nikolai Coster-Waldau on the stage at South by Southwest, and just him actually reaching out recently to interview him again, coming up for Climate Week New York for the United Nations General Assembly, and the amount of star power and political, you know, those that are really at the helm of whether or not we're going to be able to push some of these policies through, being able to just be there in the rooms with them, interviewing them, and ultimately lobbying them. And I don't want to use, I'm scared to use the word lobby sometimes because I'm not a lobbyist and it has like a very bad connotation to it. Mm-hmm. But we need to do what the other side has been doing for decades if we're going to ensure that science rules the day, if we're going to ensure that there is a global transition to clean energy. And the oil and gas industry uses lobbyists and propaganda and advertising and marketing to maintain business as usual, and business as usual is killing us. So the other side, those that are really environmentalists that are looking for a sustainable future, a just, equitable future, need to also fight fire with fire. And so that's also lobbying. And so yesterday, I'll give you an example of probably another, what I would have considered a peak otherwise. I hosted a housewarming. So I live in Washington, D.C., and I've been planning to host a housewarming for months, and it finally came together. And I had a senator, a United States senator, come as a guest. And I had Jigar Shah from the Department of Energy, who's basically runs $400 billion in the United States and allocates it towards clean energy. Such a powerful person in Washington. And they were just mingling at this event. And then I said a few words. And what I was hoping to emphasize was, we are actually lobbyists in a way, because this entire room of people, you're my friends, you're my colleagues. And the reason we're friends and colleagues, and there's a lot of overlap there. It's something about Washington, D.C., where you really can't, you can't divide up the two. The people you work with, you end up becoming like best friends with ultimately. So we are all on the side of a clean energy agenda, and we need to bring into power. And part of hosting this housewarming was to showcase the kinds of parties I'm planning on throwing, the kinds of fundraisers I'm planning on throwing to help those who have good clean energy platforms stay in power, right? So we have Senator Chris Coons, who came yesterday, who has a strong green energy platform. I want to make sure he stays in his seat. And then we need to usher in the next generation of policymakers, mm-hmm. again, with strong green platforms. And those are the kinds of events I want to host and help raise money for. So yesterday was one of those pinch me moments for sure, where I was just like, wow, am I actually, now I'm actually bringing my influential power to bringing candidates, potential candidates into office to continue to make sure that it really is science and the transition to clean energy that's at top of mind for these decision makers every day. Plus, it's hot as hell in Washington, D.C. If there was ever a time to explain how important this was, it's that it's 100 degrees in September Fahrenheit. Mm-hmm. Sorry for your audience.
That's mad. Yeah, it's boiling here in the UK at the moment, but also we're in the middle of this extreme weather explosion, or it feels like it as well. Like Hawaii, Maui was on fire, flooding everywhere from Greece to literally all over the world. And I'm flabbergasted personally that people are not taking it, or it doesn't feel like they're taking it as seriously as they should, because maybe it's because it's not our generation and it's the next generation. It's not right here, but it feels like it's on the doorstep now. It literally feels that is knocking on our door, and you can't afford not to pay attention.
No, exactly. And that's, again, why there's such an urgency. The name of my company is called We Don't Have Time. And somebody asked me, I did an Al Jazeera interview a few days ago, and there was a translator. And I'm not sure if this got lost in translation, but basically the question to me was, are we just out of time? And is that what your company is saying, that we're, you know, there's no hope? And I'm like, no, it's actually the exact opposite. And I want to make sure that I'm very clear about that. We don't have time to not act, but there is absolutely time to still solve this if everybody puts their full focus and effort into it. This is life or death. There's absolutely no point in anything else if you can't even go outside, or you have to worry about how long your children are on the playground before it becomes potentially risky to their health. That's the kind of thing that will completely disintegrate society as we know it. And so we've never been at this temperature point as humans, as species on this planet. So it's a brand new world we're living in. This is a whole new Earth. So we need to figure out how to survive in the most fair way possible with the least amount of suffering possible. So there is still opportunity to ensure we have a transition that is potentially ushering in something even better than what we've created, right? This is an opportunity to rebuild and start over in a way that really is more fair and more just, but it doesn't mean that we're out of time. There's definitely going to be some changes in how we engage with each other and society. There's going to be some readjustment of how we think about resources and space and time, right? I mean, what is mine really? How much money can I make? All of those things, I think we will need to collectively revisit. But ultimately, what that means is building a future that is more fair, that is truly more fair, and that's sustainable. I mean, where more people are living freely and healthily and happily is more security for the world, right? There's only so far you can go if you have to worry about your own, not just the environment, but also your own well-being, because there's such a disconnect between socioeconomic classes. And so that's something that it's all connected. It's all linked into how we think about this transition to clean energy and use it as an opportunity to rebuild. And we don't have time to wait, but we can actually get excited about a future that is even brighter than anything we've built before.
I could literally speak to you all day. I have like a billion questions, but unfortunately don't have time. So I've got some quick fire questions, but just before that, I was interested to know how you heard about the Women of the Future program. I understand you met Pinky recently.
Yes, and she's just a force of nature. So I really can't say no when somebody that's that pure and that genuine asks you to do something. And I just think it's absolutely brilliant what she's put together and really showcasing and highlighting women, because women have been underrepresented, of course, and have been left out of key decision-making roles historically. And we find ourselves in kind of a messy situation in the world. And so one of the tools in our toolkit is putting more women in positions of power and to highlight and to celebrate those that are already there or that are going in that direction. And that's something that Pinky's been doing. And it's of critical importance because it can ultimately reshape how we think about addressing some of these key challenges that we face globally. So I absolutely love and support what's happening with her organization.
Oh, thank you so much. Right, some quick fire questions if you're ready. What would you describe as your greatest success?
Establishing We Don't Have Time in the United States and North America. The company is based out of Stockholm, Sweden, known for launching Greta Thunberg. That's kind of what we're attached to, but we are so much more now in terms of bringing in all of these different young people from around the world to really highlight their successes. So me establishing this company in the US and scaling it allows everyone else's efforts to also be amplified. And I just love that's something I can provide, that tool. So that's my greatest success.
And your greatest failure?
My greatest failure is not giving myself enough time to reflect and cherish the good things I've been able to accomplish. I think that's another key thing women do. We're always, well, I don't want to generalize, but Indian women is a little bit more specific, but culturally, I think we're always feeling guilty about something. It's ingrained in us, maybe from childhood. So I think my greatest failure is not overcoming that yet. It's a work in progress, but I look forward to when I can actually remove the burden of guilt.
That's a good one. Okay, so the mantra of Women of the Future is kindness and collaboration. What does that mean to you in both your personal and professional life?
That's what it is. We have to lead with compassion because everybody is different. Everybody has different priorities and everybody has different experiences that you will never understand unless you're truly walking in their shoes. Mm. And so leading with compassion is so key, and it allows for that shared understanding, which creates trust. Mm. And trust is what makes the world go around. You need a minimal amount of trust. And again, this is entrenched in science. This was my whole research for years out of the UK. You need trust for a basic interaction of just like, I will pay you for doing this for me. But then you need societal trust just to be able to engage across borders to ensure that, you know, we're going to be able to live and share this beautiful planet. And so that starts with compassion for somebody who isn't exactly like you. So it's absolutely critical, not just for the work that's we're talking about here, but generally for us as humans. And collaboration, once you have trust, you have collaboration. And collaboration is everything to solving this climate crisis and all of these global challenges that we collectively face. So of course we need collaboration.
Is there anything that scares you?
What scares me is having children. I have been thinking about it for some time. I'm not part of the movement necessarily where I'm not going to have children because of the climate crisis, but I am terrified of a child in the future looking at me and saying, you knew the planet was going to be this hostile and you still decided to have children. I know, I hear from everyone when I say express this, and I'm being completely honest. If you haven't picked up on this already, I'm super honest and transparent just because I don't have the burden of worrying about what people think about me. So that is something that I am free from. But no, I'm terrified of having children if we don't solve this crisis. So that's why I put everything day in and day out into as my contribution to overcoming the climate crisis we're in, so that there's a livable, breathable, habitable, hospitable environment for the next generation. So I don't have future children, you know, that I have to worry about their health and I have to worry about their general discomfort or even potential anger. And we see children angry today, right?
Yeah.
State of the planet. So it's not unheard of to think you're having children could result in them being very angry at you. So that really does scare me. So we have to solve this.
Well, I had a really difficult conversation with my six-year-old the other day. She loves penguins. And I don't know what I was thinking. I just said, oh, they might not be here if Antarctica melts, you're not going to have any penguins. And she actually went off into a different room and started crying. And I kind of chastised myself for maybe not communicating that to her better. And then we looked on like the WWF site and see what we could do to try and help or any way that she could help and that kind of thing. But for a six-year-old, it's quite simplistic. She doesn't want her to be no more penguins. So it's just like, it's the hardest thing to try and translate, but so important as well.
No, exactly. And so I would say that's my fear. But again, what you're doing is exactly what needs to be done, is talking about it, not sugarcoating things, but then really leading with action and hope and saying, okay, so this is the challenge. This is potentially what's at risk, but what can we do? What could we do together? And it's a great way to also bond with your child. So exactly. I love that.
Finally, what is left on your to-do list?
I will not be satisfied until we have in the United States a government that is truly making decisions based on evidence. And that is something that will take one candidate to be elected at a time. So that is something I'm very much into now, supporting that effort, convincing the American public, especially the next generation, to vote, right? Because it really is the power of getting the appropriate people into positions of power so that we can overcome some of these challenges. So that's one in the US. And then broadly, globally, I would like to see better collaboration across borders through existing multilateral organizations like the UN. A lot of people complain about the UN, but it's what we have. It's what we're going to work with. The UN General Assembly is coming up. I'm very lucky to be involved in that. I will be participating as part of the General Assembly. And it really is an opportunity to build some bridges, especially across those frontiers of science that everyone, regardless of what country you're in, can get excited about, right? I'm talking about like deep sea exploration and space exploration. And a lot of that can be where we find collaboration. And a lot of that collaboration can also support addressing some of the challenges we have on the planet with the climate. So yeah, just continuing to do my part in this and having a family. On a more personal note, that is something that is still left to do.
I've said it before, I could speak to you for hours. You're an amazing woman, so engaging, so interesting, and so passionate. Thank you. Huge thanks for taking the time to speak to me today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Woman of the Future podcast. If you enjoyed it, please hit the subscribe button. And while you're there, why not give us a rating and review? You know you want to. For more about the Women of the Future Awards, network and initiative, please visit www.womenofthefuture.co.uk. See you soon!